Welcome to week 10 of our Bible study of Genesis. I'm so happy that you have stuck with us for 10 weeks, and I hope that you've been blessed by what we're learning about God, about God's people, about sin, about consequences, but most of all about what a great salvation we have. So this week, we're going to kind of go backwards. Last week, we looked at Joseph and his life. We are going to scoot back, kind of backwards in Genesis, and look around chapters 33 to 47. So we're going to kind of go back before Joseph was sold into slavery and all that happened there last week. And we're going to go to before that and then to the end of Jacob's life when Genesis closes. Next week, we're going to look at our final lesson, which actually backs back up and looks at Genesis and Revelation 21. So just wanted to kind of get you situated where we are in the Bible study. I know that 10 to 12 weeks is not a lot of time to study Genesis, but we are trying to get these broad strokes, and I know it's going fast. So hang on, buckle up, we're going to do it again. So let's pray before we get started. Lord, you're so good to us. Thank you for everything from this makeshift studio to your word to what is going on in all the ladies' lives that hear this right now. You see what's going on in my own life as I speak it and how kind of flustered I am. I ask that you would just calm my heart, that I would say what you want me to say, that you would just remind me of your truths that you've taught us in Genesis and beyond. Thank you for these women. I ask that you would build up our community through your word and through the relationships you've given us with one another. In your son's name we pray, amen. Okay, so like I said, last week we looked at Joseph. This week we're back to Jacob, his sons, and life after he left Laban and has come back to the area he left, his family's kind of part of the world, back to the land that God promised would be Abraham's. And if you remember when he left the land to escape Esau in his anger, he had a dream of a ladder. And that happened in Bethel, and he's coming back. And if you remember, he had made a vow that if God took care of them, of him when he had nothing, that he would worship him there. So that's kind of where we are looking at Jacob when he comes back. He survives the encounter with Esau, and we pick up in chapter 33. Because Jacob doesn't really go back to Bethel like he was supposed to. This coming back home, this coming back to be God's and worship him and have a life that he had vowed would be God's, he's not really off to a good start. He's already off the path, and he's not doing what he promised years ago, but instead buys land in Shechem and settles there. And then chapter after chapter, if we believed in luck, he would have bad luck. He had just a mess. His life really is just messy. There's no other way to say it. So verse 34, his daughter Dinah is raped by someone outside their family, and her two brothers, Simeon and Levi, trick the town and kill all the people as a result. In a way, you see Jacob not be a good head of his household. He doesn't seem to respond to the injustice that was done to his own daughter. And yet, Simeon and Levi are kind of like weirdly not doing justice correctly either. So it's just kind of a mess, and it's hard to watch. So then by chapter 35, Jacob leaves Shechem and does go to Bethel like he was supposed to do. And that's where there's this odd little note of Rebecca. So that's Jacob's mother's nurse dies. And I think in a way, this is such a sweet verse that shows that, remember when Jacob left to go marry Isaac, that she took with her nurse. This woman has been on the longest ride of her life, because we see that she has been around and has actually gone with This is with Rachel and her family. And it's just interesting to note that that burial and that death meant something. I don't know how she ended up there with Jacob, but you have to wonder if this is a reminder and like an end tie with his mother and with his family and with his former life. So that's a sad thing that happens. And then he moves again, and really a death blow happens because his favorite wife, the woman he has loved for years, his favorite Rachel, dies in childbirth, delivering his final son, Benjamin. We also see while all this is happening in chapter 35 that his oldest son, Reuben, sleeps with Bilhah, one of the concubines that Leah had given Jacob. So it's kind of like sleeping with your stepmother. It's a play for authority, probably. It's bad, it's gross, and it's just one more knock in the family tree. By chapter 35, verse 27, Jacob goes and sees his father Isaac, and we see that relationship come full circle, and he's actually burying Isaac with Esau. So that just kind of all those losses are building up, and then chapter 37 hits when Joseph disappears. So you can see how Jacob probably felt about his life at this point. In the meantime, Judah, by chapter 38, the number five son, he has the whole encounter with Tamar that we talked about in our summer study when we looked at the genealogy of Christ and the women that are in Matthew 1, and how Tamar was was alone and without help, and Judah was not taking care of her. So she tricks Judah into sleeping with her, and just, so it's just like a giant soap opera or one of the Netflix shows that would have M.A. written there. Be careful. Don't watch this in front of your children. It's just kind of getting raunchy by this point. By 42 to 44, we see the famine and the brothers going to get help. And we see chapter 45 when Joseph is found. Things turn around, and by chapter 46, Jacob is leaving this promised land, and he worships at Beersheba, and God tells him in Genesis 46 that it's okay. It's okay to leave and go to Egypt. So let's read Genesis 46, 1 through 4. So Israel, remember that's Jacob's new name, took his journey with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. And God spoke to Israel in visions of the night and said, Jacob, Jacob. And he said, here I am. Then he said, I am God, the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for there I will make you into a great nation. I myself will go down with you to Egypt, and I will also bring you up again, and Joseph's hand shall close your eyes. Okay, remember what God told Abraham a few weeks ago in chapter 15, verses 13 through 15. He told Abraham, this is before Isaac was even born, your descendants are going to go to a land and they're going to be mistreated. And so I'm wondering if Jacob thinks, am I about to usher in all this heartache? I wonder if Jacob thought, am I leaving the protection of God's promised land? All these things, and God is so sweet to Jacob, repeating his name tenderly and saying, I am not limited to this little dotted line, this boundary line on a map. I'm going with you to Egypt. I'm not leaving you. And so you kind of hear these covenantal promises we've heard to Abraham. There, this place, my relationship is not limited to this stretch of land. My presence is going with you, and you are going to be a great people. So we hear those echoes as Jacob leaves this land. He gets to Egypt, and he meets the Pharaoh. Let's read in Genesis 47. Thus Israel settled in the land of Egypt, in the land of Goshen, and they gained possessions in it and were fruitful and multiplied greatly. And Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years. So the days of Jacob, the years of his life, were 147 years. if you look at where before that, when Joseph meets Pharaoh, Pharaoh asks him, how many are the days of the years of your life? Okay, so he, when he meets him, we see that he moved there. He lived there for about 13 years, but he was 130 when he got there. And this is what Jacob says to Pharaoh. The days of my years of my sojourning are 130 years. Few and evil have been the days of the years of my life, and they have not attained to the days of the years of my of the life of my fathers in the days of their sojourning. And Jacob blessed Pharaoh and went out from the presence of Pharaoh. I want us to notice that Jacob says his life has been messy. His life has not been great. He sees his life as hard, as being full of mess ups, of being impacted by the mess ups of his family. His sons are just, we're gonna see later, just that they're a dirty dozen. They are not these stellar sons. And why God has picked this family, I don't know. I think it's interesting that we see Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, being blessed by Jacob. Now you think if you came to someone's country, Pharaoh is like he's younger than Jacob, but he's also the authority of the land, but yet he is asking about Jacob, about his life, and he is receiving a blessing from Jacob. And I want that to kick in the promise that God told Abraham. The nations will be blessed through your seed. And here we see Jacob, this Israel, blessing Pharaoh in Egypt. And that is just really cool to start seeing these things. These are images of how this salvation is going to be for all time. We're going to see a little bit more of that next week. So he gives a blessing. Pharaoh receives a blessing from this messy man, from this messy failure of a man. He's not even in his home turf anymore. But God is with him, and God has promised. His life is full of heartache. His favorite person in the world died. His second favorite, Joseph, disappeared. He has lived through incest, division, crimes, murder. He's bringing a messy group to Egypt. But this is the bottom line that I want us to take away from this picture, is God's grace is stronger than any of that mess. That God's grace is stronger than our sin, stronger than the harsh life you may be having right now, the impact of your family on your life, the world around us, the harshness of COVID, the harshness of the political unrest, the harshness of just sin and everything around us, that God is stronger and his plan for us is stronger and more sure than our uncertain presence. And so in Genesis 47 and 27 through 31, I want us to take our second point by looking at this deathbed worship, these deathbed end-of-life scenes, because Jacob did enjoy living there for like 13 years, but we see the end of his life coming at the end of this book of Genesis. And so I've already read a little bit from 47, but I want to pick up in verse 29. And when the time drew near that Israel must die, he called his son Joseph and said to him, if now I have found favor in your sight, put your hand under my thigh and promise to deal kindly and truly with me. Do not bury me in Egypt, but let me lie with my fathers. Let me carry me out of Egypt and bury me in their burying place. He, that's Joseph, answered, I will do as you have said. And he said to me, swear to me. And he swore to him. Then Israel bowed himself upon the head of his bed. Okay, so what's going on here? He's sick. He's dying. He knows it. And we see where he goes in this kind of end of life, in his death, and on his deathbed, he goes to God's promises. And he makes Joseph swear, you will bury my bones in the promised land, because I know God is going to take you out of here. And you've got to promise me that I will be buried with my fathers. And it is this dying wish that shows how much he believes God's promises. So Joseph swears to him he'll do that. Now, if you read in Hebrews 11:21, we see that this was an act of faith. That Hebrews 11:21 says, "By faith Jacob, when dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph, bowing in worship over the head of his staff." Okay, what is going on? What is the writer of Hebrews saying? Okay, not only do we see Jacob having faith that God's going to keep his promises and God's people will return to this land, but he also blesses Joseph's sons. And so this is important. So let's read chapter 48 and read along, because this is kind of a scene that we're going to show. "After this, Joseph was told, 'Behold, your father is ill.' So he took with him his two sons. Remember, these are the ones that were born to him in Egypt that we've already talked about their names, Manasseh and Ephraim. And it was told to Jacob, 'Your son Joseph has come to you.' Then Israel summoned his strength and sat up in bed. And Jacob said to Joseph, 'God Almighty appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed me and said to me, Behold, I will make you fruitful and multiply you, and I will make of you a company of peoples and will give this land to your offspring after you for an everlasting possession. And now your two sons who were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to you in Egypt are mine. Ephraim and Manasseh shall be mine, as Reuben and Simeon are. And the children that you fathered after them shall be yours. They shall be called by the name of their brothers in their inheritance. As for me, when I came down from Padan, to my sorrow, Rachel died in the land of Canaan on the way, when there was still some distance to go to Ephrath, and I buried her there on the way to Ephrath, that is Bethlehem. When Israel saw Joseph's sons, he said, 'Who are these?' Joseph said to his father, 'These are my sons, whom God has given me here.' And he said, 'Bring them to me, please, that I may bless them.' Now the eyes of Israel were dim with age, so that they could not see. So Joseph brought them near him, and he kissed them and embraced them. And Israel said to Joseph, 'I never expected to see your face. And behold, God has let me see your offspring also.' Then Joseph removed them from his knees, and he bowed himself with his face to the earth. And Joseph took them both, Ephraim in his right hand toward Israel's left hand, and Manasseh in his left hand toward Israel's right hand, and brought them near him. And Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it on the head of Ephraim, who was the younger, and his left hand on the head of Manasseh, crossing his hands, for Manasseh was the firstborn." Okay, let's pause right there. Does this remind you of another scene? Does this remind you of Isaac when he was blind and couldn't see? Does this remind you of the blessing getting crossed somehow? But this time it was by faith, and it was on purpose, and it was good. Joseph, we're going to see, reacts against this. And he blessed Joseph and said, "The God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has been my shepherd all my life long to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless these boys. And in them let my name be carried on in the name of my fathers Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth." When Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand on the head of Ephraim, it displeased him, and he took his father's hand to move it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head. And Joseph said to his father, "Not this way, my father. Since this one is the firstborn, put your right hand on his head." But his father refused and said, "I know, my son, I know. He also shall become a people, and he also shall be great. Nevertheless, his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his offspring shall become a multitude of nations." So he blessed them that day, saying, "By you Israel will pronounce blessing, saying, 'God make you as Ephraim and Manasseh.'" Thus he put Ephraim before Manasseh. Then Israel said to Joseph, "Behold, I'm about to die, but God will be with you and will bring you again to the land of your fathers." I know there's a lot in that story, but I think it's really important for us to see how God is undoing things in the past and what is happening here, because it informs us about our salvation. He gives the synopsis of the promises and his authority to pass this birthright on to Joseph's sons. What we see is Israel, Jacob, adopts Joseph's sons as his own. So instead of having on the family tree just Joseph, instead there are two branches. Joseph gets a double portion. His sons were born in the order of Manasseh and Ephraim, but now Ephraim is like the older one and is in front of the younger, in front of the older. So we see again this picture of Joseph, and I love how these details are in there. It's like you can see, like, oh my goodness, Dad can't see if he's swapping it up and I've got to fix it. And I don't know, when Jacob says, I know, it's like, I know what I'm doing. Or if it's, I get how this is hard for you. I know this doesn't make sense. But either way, Jacob knows exactly what he's doing. And from the writer in Hebrews, we know this is by faith. Jacob can't see. He can't see right in front of him. And he can't see the future except to trust and see what God has said would happen. And so this is how we have, when you look at the 12 tribes of Israel, Ephraim and Manasseh are there, and not a tribe called Joseph. So I like those kind of details, and that's where this comes from. And by adopting them, the children's, these boys' identity, they're not outcasts. They're not, you know, those kids from Egypt. They're like really half covenant kids. No. He's making them full partakers, these outcasts of a shepherd race. They're outcasts in Egypt, but yet they're also kind of outcasts from, would they be outcasts from their own covenant family? And no, just because they're of this royal line and authority in Egypt and grew up with an Egyptian mother and in the land of Egypt did not make them less covenant kids in Jacob's family. And so we see that, like, he uses Moses, like he uses the line of Tamar and Judah, this weird incestuous liaison with twins there that is kind of a wacky birth. We see how God's promises are so fulfilled using the most unlikely situation. And so part of what is happening with this trade also is, you know, the promises in Egypt, this idea that the Joseph's family was in Egypt, they were kept separate from the Egyptians because they were shepherds. Because the Egyptians didn't really want to mix culture with shepherds, and it really protected Jacob's family in Egypt from intermarrying and becoming impacted by Egyptian culture. So we see all this craziness, all this mix and match, how I would not plan it, but God taking care of these promises to Jacob with his children in Egypt. So he gives them this double birthright. He gives them the blessings of the covenant, a seed, a posterity to be a people. And we see that he needed faith to die well. He needed to trust that God was going to take care of his children in this foreign land. And he would. How does that impact you when you're worried, when you do not see how things are going to work out and you know you're leaving the scene? That may not be like you're dying. It may be that you're letting your child go to school for the first time. It may be that you're leaving your family and going with a spouse away from where you grew up. It may be you're going to college for the first time and stepping out alone. It could be you have an illness and you're not going to be able to serve your family the way you have been able to. There are a million ways that God challenges us as women to let go and let God take care of our people. And Jacob is having to let go and trust God. So, what do you need faith to believe? How do you worship God? Because the writer in Hebrews said this was an act of faith for him to worship on the edge of all this uncertainty. So think about that and ask God for faith. But two things to note before we move on. Don't you think the original readers of this story, who were God's people leaving Egypt 400 years after this story, that this was a great encouragement, that they got to see their identity and their history so much that they kind of see that this was all planned. They see a connection to the 12 sons, to the tribes of Israel and how they got to be the way they are. We see history for their family. We also see that Jacob, for the first time, a father, a daddy in the chosen line, all his children are included in the covenant promises. That it wasn't, well, you know, and Esau, not going to have the covenant through him, we're going to have Jacob. It's not that this way. Of all his 12 sons, all 12 sons are going to the promised land. All 12 sons, even though they were a raunchy, rowdy group, all 12 are part of this promise. And that is something just that I want us to point out. And all 12 are going to become the people of God. So let's look at this dirty dozen. Let's read chapter 49. We're just going to read a few of the verses. And I'm hoping in your handout that you will have this piece of paper. And you can kind of follow along. I love a colored kind of piece of paper chart that helps me kind of get the imprint of what all these verses say. But I'm going to do a flyby on the 12 sons that we see Jacob blessing in chapter 49 as he all his sons gather together and receive his last words. Let's start in verse 1. Then Jacob called his sons and said, "Gather yourselves together that I may tell you what shall happen to you in the days to come." So here we go. Can you imagine getting to hear that invitation? Daddy wants you to come to his deathbed and he's going to tell you what's going to happen. And here's where we see sin's consequences come up. Because the Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might, and the first fruits of my strength, preeminent in dignity and preeminent in power. Unstable as water, you shall not have preeminence, because you went up to your father's bed, then you defiled it. He went up to my couch. Simeon and Levi are brothers. Weapons of violence are their swords. Let my soul not come into their counsel. O, my glory, be not joined to their company. For in their anger they killed men, and in their willfulness they hamstrung oxen. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. Judah, your brothers shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's son shall bow down before you. Judah is a lion's cub. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He stooped down. He crouched as a lion and as a lioness. Who dares rouse him? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until tribute comes to him. And to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. Binding his foal to the vine and his donkey's colt to the choice wine, he has washed his garments in wine and his vesture in the blood of grapes. His eyes are darker than wine and his teeth whiter than milk. Okay, why do I want to bring those out? Well, first of all, this explains some things we're going to see in the rest of Scripture. And this will be really fun for you to kind of keep in the back of your mind as you see other prophecies about the Messiah, other things that will happen in the Old Testament and beyond. So first of all, Reuben, remember, he's the oldest son that about the time of when, I guess, Jacob left, he slept with his stepmother. And this was a play for authority. It takes away his firstborn status, the sin. Simeon, he and Levi are the two brothers that killed the town over Dinah's rape. And he says, you have lost blessing because of this. One of the things you'll see about Levi is he will be scattered. And so when you look at a map of the 12 tribes of Israel after, you know, Exodus, when Joshua takes them in and there's a map, look for Levi, and you don't see a boundary with Levi on it, because Levi was the tribe of priests, and the priests lived all across. They were scattered throughout the people of Israel. So It's just what's going to happen. That actually probably sounded bad to Levi at the moment, but later his children would be scattered, but for a wonderful blessing. But I really want to focus on Judah right here, because here's where we see God put a star and says, this is going to be the tribe that is going to always have the scepter, that's going to always have authority. So this is the tribe you trace and find King David. You find Jesus. You find that this scepter that will never go away is because Jesus himself is of the tribe. So I think that is fascinating. We see that barren Rachel, who eventually had children, that her sons get so much more in a ratio of the others in that fight between Leah and Rachel. But we see Leah getting the son that the authority and the kingly line will be with one of Leah's sons, which I think is also so sweet, because she was the unwanted mother. She was the unloved wife. But that's the woman that birthed this kingly line. So we see Jesus in this family tree. We see him in Judah. We see him later Tamar and Judah, the trick pregnancy. It was Tamar's son that became the line under Judah. So we see all these unlikely recruits to be God's people. We see that later Jesus himself chooses 12 disciples who are also a dirty dozen, also unlikely recruits to build his church. And what I love about this and what I want us to walk away with this from this lesson is God and what he does is greater than the messes we create. Despite Jacob's rough, messy life, despite the dirty dozen reputation of his 12 sons, it's grace, grace, grace. And this same grace is reflected forever in his people. So what is it that you must believe today? Is God trustworthy based on what you've seen in Genesis, despite what you see in your messy life? And does your dirty, messy self define you? Or does this grace define you? We will see next week that this wrestling that Jacob has, this messy life, lives on, and that God never stops struggling with his people, but he always leaves them blessed. He never abandons them. He never wipes them out like we saw in Noah's day. We will see that God won't stop saving you. He didn't stop saving them, and he won't stop saving you. Despite your wrestling, despite your failures, you're blessed. Go live in light of that. Thank you.